Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Getting students excited about discovery and learning and about their own talents and abilities, that's the job of the school teacher. But today, enthusiasm for that work, as important as it is to a functioning society, is in jeopardy. The Coalition to Sustain the Education Profession was launched last fall by the Kentucky Association of School Administrators. Five coalition members recently testified before the House Education Committee in Frankfort, and we're joined by coalition co-chairs David Meinschein, he's superintendent of schools in Livingston County, and Hardin County Superintendent Terry Morgan. And I want to welcome you both to Eastern Standard.
Thanks for having us.
And so first, and either of you can take this first question, but I'm just curious, why was the coalition formed and what is its makeup?
About a year ago, Ron Caldwell, the executive director for KASA, held a meeting between school administrators around the sense of urgency we needed to have about the decline in teachers entering our profession and the volume of teachers exiting our profession. And we realized at that time that some work needed to be done in an urgent fashion. So, as we approached this, this thought process to bring the thought leaders from across the state and have a grassroots campaign, the coalition was birthed from that initial conversation.
So what the coalition noticed and superintendents were reporting is that we simply do not have the teachers applying for our positions that we have in the district. And while we have many emergency certifications, so it may look like in the state that all of our positions are filled, but it is who is filling those positions. And so, for example, in Hardin County, we have had 80 resignations since the school year started, and many of those are positions that were being filled by emergency certified teachers or option six teachers. And so we want to make sure that we have a pipeline of teachers that have gone through a traditional program or a quality program to ensure that our applicants are what we want in front of our students teaching and that they can provide the rich experiences for our students.
Well, I know that this increase in resignations and retirements certainly occurred during the pandemic, but was this going on for some time before the pandemic?
Yes, we believe that it has been going on for some time. And now we're just seeing a natural progression in the process of there are more teachers exiting the profession at this point.
And so what's going on? Why are qualified teachers in short supply?
I think when you look at, I will share with you the number one thing that I'm hearing from teachers in our district is it really is lacking not receiving the respect that they felt that they had for their teachers when they were going through school. And they do not feel they are getting the parent support in some situations. And then when you consider the political climate, they feel a great level of disrespect. And this has always been seen as a respectable profession. And that does not seem to be the case any longer. And when you are working as hard as our teachers are working and you are showing that level of dedication, you want to receive that respect from everyone, especially those who represent us across our state and across our nation.
Well, the coalition is calling for a comprehensive study of the state of public education in Kentucky, and that includes perceptions of and attitudes toward the teaching profession, as you just alluded to, as well as a comprehensive wage and benefit analysis. But let's continue on that thread for just a bit. What sorts of perceptions and attitudes are being encountered?
Well, I think if you just look at the recent testimony before the Education Committee the other day in Frankfort, you had several individuals making statements about public schools and what is happening in public schools. But yet they couldn't give us any specific examples of where this was taking place and where they're getting their information from. I'll be honest, I know some of the people who represent my district have not been in our schools that are on the Education Committee. Samara Heverin has been in our district multiple times. Steve Bratcher, a newly elected individual, as well as Matt Dineen, they have already been in our schools. And some of the folks on that committee have not been in our schools to see what is happening. So I'm not real sure where they're getting their information from.
Well, it seems the political rhetoric around education has certainly become, well, maybe toxic. And yet, as you point out, there often isn't much basis to support that rhetoric. It would seem that that would be pretty easy to counter or dispel, but it isn't, is it?
When you look at the structure of the coalition, it's divided into a group studying recruiting, a group studying retention. But one of the most important aspects of this campaign is to look at marketing and look at marketing of our profession. You're right. When I think about our profession, ours is a noble profession. Ours is perhaps the greatest profession of all. It has the ability to impact all other professions and disciplines. You know, I think about it has the power to transform minds and the thoughts of people. It's unparalleled in its ability to influence economic development. And when I think about that, we don't say it enough. So, you know, within the profession, we've got to tout what we're doing and the impact we have on the world around us. So it needs to begin with us. But yes, definitely with politicians, being in our school systems and seeing the great things that are going on, seeing the quality of educators that we have. There needs to be a basis for our marketing campaign that's positive and bring our profession back into a positive light where we're respected and those around us can see the great things that we're doing and the impact we have on our communities and the Commonwealth.
Well, if somebody is persuaded, convinced that this might be a track they want to be on and they're considering becoming a teacher, what do they need to ask themselves in order to decide whether they're right for the classroom?
I think the biggest thing is they need to ask if they want to be part of something bigger than themselves. Do they want to see their work grow into greater things?
Information and digital technologies have evolved in big ways over the past decade, and I'm just wondering if these changes have made it more difficult to teach, or have they improved the experience?
I believe both. I believe they've definitely improved the experience of teaching. The ability to reach out across the world and to collaborate and to communicate with people of different people groups and to share information and knowledge has increased the ability to teach.
The world with technology is much smaller, but we also have students with attention spans because they are on their cell phones a lot, as well as the adults. We are really seeing the need for that human connection, to have that teacher in front of that classroom or sitting with the students and allowing those students to exchange ideas and learning about communication and how to do that beyond technology is really important for us. So nothing is going to replace that human connection.
You're calling on the legislature to mandate creation of a single portal for teacher preparation, recruitment, and application. Why is that needed?
That simplifies the process for those who choose to come into our profession. It's, you know, it's a tool for them to be able to find all the information necessary in one location to make it a seamless process. Just integrating all of our systems together into one platform will be much easier for a person to figure out what it, you know, how to be credentialed and what it takes to become a teacher.
And it looks to be an even bigger call on the legislature is to mandate that every school district be required to implement a teacher recruitment and induction system. There are, you know, 171 districts in Kentucky, and some are very sparsely populated with very weak tax bases. Would there be exceptions in those cases, or would there be a need for states' supplementation of those districts?
I think we can incorporate some of the ideas of that portal to have a more centralized location. And I know those smaller districts, more rural districts, are going to have to be very creative in finding those. But I don't think you can do an overreaching and make one fit for every district. So I think each district needs to have that autonomy to find what will work for them.
I'm in a smaller rural district. And our educational cooperative, the West Kentucky Educational Cooperative, is developing a teacher induction system to serve our area in Western Kentucky. So there are multiple models that could be used.
Okay. Also being proposed in Frankfort is a student loan forgiveness program for teachers who've been certified by the Kentucky Educational Professional Standards Board. Would that make a difference in recruiting, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. We in Hardin County have a Grow Your Own program to where we are paying one-third of the tuition of our paraprofessionals and are very fortunate that Western Kentucky University is matching that. And while the reimbursement program is great, what we have to realize is for some students, they don't have that money up front. And therefore, they would have to borrow the money. And when you start talking about loans, you've heard through social media and through the news links that, hey, there's all of this debt, and regardless of what profession you go into, you may have college debt and it take you years to do this. So I think offering tuition assistance as they're going through the program would help. And I definitely think a reimbursement program would help, but I do think we have to think of those who will see that that's a block for them. How are they going to come up with that money up front to pay for schooling?
Well, we've been talking about teachers here, and the focus of the coalition is on teachers, but what about you all? What about superintendents? What about principals? Are there issues in recruiting school administrators?
We certainly have seen a decrease in the number of individuals applying for our principal positions. And I believe that's going to continue with the level of stress that happens at the administrative level. Our hope is that when we get more teachers interested in education, we will then have the greater opportunity to encourage people to go into leadership. Even if they don't take a principal's position, how can we help you be a better leader of your peers? And then you may consider going into that leadership position.
I absolutely believe that the pipeline has decreased for administrators. But again, I think about this is the greatest profession. I have a unique background in that I've been able to, I was a military officer. I worked in a Fortune 500 company, and I worked in a startup environment before coming into education. I see none of those things as important as to what I do now. It allows me to ply my trade as a leader, and I believe that there are a couple of things that will change fundamentally our system of education today across the nation. And I believe there is a silver bullet. One, that's teachers. Teachers are the answer to solving all the educational woes. They will increase student achievement, and they will do it on their shoulders. But they can't exist without strong leaders. And I believe educational leadership positions provide leaders the opportunity to ply their trade to solve complex problems that need to be solved for our students. So this is a great place to be a leader. But yes, I believe that the pipeline has definitely diminished over the past couple of years.
All right, that's David Meinschein, Superintendent of Schools in Livingston County, and Hardin County Superintendent Terry Morgan, co-chairs of the Coalition to Sustain the Education Profession. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Teachers are essential to learning, but so are parents. And that's the focus of the co-host of our series on education, Bridget Blom.
Many can resonate with the adage that parenting is one of the most difficult jobs, and yet the job with the least amount of training. And we can appreciate that with more income, parents are able to pay for supports and experiences for their children that parents with lower incomes can often afford. The primary systemic response to this age-old problem is public education. And what we see, especially in poor areas, Kentucky being one of those places, with median household income ranking 44th in the nation and childhood poverty 43rd, is a request of our schools to do more and more to close the gap between what parents can do and afford and what they can't. Nate Hilger has begun to tackle this problem by digging deeply into the research regarding the quote-unquote origins of success in children. Dr. Hilger is an economist, data scientist, and author of the book, The Parent Trap: How to Stop Overloading Parents and Fix Our Inequality Crisis. Nate, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having me, Bridget. It's really a pleasure to be here.
In your book, you start by framing parenting as the largest industry in the United States. Help us understand that frame on parenting.
Sure. Suppose, something crazy happened and suddenly nobody wanted to have kids anymore. In that case, if we wanted our, civilization to continue, we would have to make it worth people's while, like any other job that we have to pay people to do. And it's interesting to think about how much we would have to pay to compel people to do what parents today are doing.
It's expensive.
It is very expensive. It's time-consuming, and it involves a lot of expertise and commitment. To begin, in a sort of counterintuitive way, a typical surrogate pregnancy, in the small number of cases where people pay someone to carry a baby to term, costs $100,000 to $150,000. That's because pregnancy, as you know, Bridget, is a very involved process. After that, there's breastfeeding. Wet nurses make about $57,000 per year. We take all of this labor that women provide in our society for granted, but it has enormous value. After that, parents obviously spend a huge amount of time caring for children, and we have to value that somehow. A lot of that is beyond 40 hours a week. It's overnight. It's after hours. And that means we should value it at overtime, because workers who work at odd hours and overnight hours, they do get paid more on average. So these are the kinds of calculations that go into the result that I highlight in the book, that if you really value the labor that parents invest in children, it amounts to the biggest industry in our economy, over $5 trillion annually.
Wow. So really costing out, putting a price tag on the things that parents do to prepare the next generation and the next generation of our workforce.
Yeah. And, you can even sanity check this against sometimes foster care is provided in what is known as congregate care or group home settings. And that's kind of like paying people to be parents for kids. That costs about $50,000 per year per kid. And that's providing relatively much lower quality of care than what parents are providing today. So it's just a monumental amount of valuable labor that parents are pouring into our society every year.
You describe parenting as a mix of caring for a child and helping a child build skills. You argue it's in the skill building that a systems approach can help level the playing field for more equitable outcomes and arguably strengthen our economy. Why should skill building not be left to parents in the current time students are in school?
The reason why we should not ask too much of parents when it comes to building skills in children is because they will fail. Skill building today in America is perceived artificially as something that anybody can do in their spare time on their own dollar if they just put a little love and effort into it. But skill building is much more complicated than we've been led to believe. Getting reluctant, distractible kids to learn how to do things like, reading and math, to name the basic ones, but also to build skills like tenacity and conflict resolution and confidence. There's a wide range of skills that have enormous value in the labor market, and it takes a lot of professional expertise and training and experience and practice to really build these skills effectively. There are a lot of tricks and techniques that can help you do it better, and parents are not well situated to just pull these out of a hat and start applying them in their day-to-day life. And there are deep reasons for this. One example of a force that makes it hard for parents to raise kids to build all the skills that children need is that parents only raise one or two or three or maybe four kids. Compare that to a teacher who teaches algebra or geometry every year to perhaps 100 kids. That teacher gets a lot more practice seeing the same kinds of conceptual misunderstandings and behavioral obstacles every year. And the data showed that teachers get a lot more efficient over time from that practice. Parents don't have that kind of opportunity.
So, and the longer we do something, the better we get at it. And so one might argue that by the time we're finished raising children, we might be good at it. but we didn't have all that prior experience when we started out on that path.
Well, that's kind of there's another way to look at it, Bridget, which is that you get 18 years of practice raising a kid, but in a sense, you don't get that because you take each child through the each phase one time. You're going through the child care conundrum one time. You're going through, you know, struggles with eighth grade math one time per kid. You're going through the college labyrinth one time with each kid. Whereas professionals, they're dedicated to just that stage and just that domain in a child's upbringing. So I think parents don't really get 18 years of practice. They get to see each phase, which involves a lot of complicated decisions and problems, one time per child.
So I think one of the issues you raise that we know is important is childcare and the importance of that developmental environment for a young developing brain, but also the workforce piece. I want to come back around to childcare and first ask you, Nate, to talk about some of the issues in addition to childcare, where you see an opportunity for direct support of parents and youth in a more systemic way that builds these skills.
Child care is getting a lot of attention, and as you point out, but thanks for the question, because there are so many other areas where we can make great impacts on families' lives, empowering parents to achieve their own goals. Before we even get to child care, there's paid parental leave. The evidence here suggests that letting parents have those first few months to form that bond with their kid in a less stressful environment where they don't have to worry about paychecks is extremely beneficial both for the parents and the kid's long-term development. And then there's early education, as you mentioned. After that, we have a lot of room to provide more opportunity in after-school and summer environments where rich kids, you know, they're going to fancy summer camps, they're getting tutoring, they're going to private music and sports lessons, and a lot of lower-income kids don't have those kinds of opportunities, and they could. There's also tutoring and counseling for things like college and career decisions, which are very complicated and overwhelming for most families to tackle on their own. There's college financial aid and support, especially for kids whose parents haven't been through college and can't help them handle all the complicated, confusing aspects of college. There's vocational training and apprenticeships, which are hard for kids to identify and understand without more support. There's healthcare because, you know, I don't know, Bridget, I don't know if you know this, but Medicaid, which is our public health system for lower income kids, it reimburses physicians about 70% as generously as Medicare. So that's an example of how we shortchange families compared to other groups in our society. And then another area where I think we have a lot of room to improve is foster care, where these kids currently have really bad outcomes and would benefit from much richer investments in their skill development. And I want to highlight that this might strike some listeners as utopian or socialist, but it would all be very feasible. It would put more power into parents' hands, and it would cost about half as much as Medicare, based on my calculations.
And it's ensuring better outcomes, not so unlike, taking care of your own dental health care needs versus calling in a dentist to take care of some of those things.
Absolutely. What all of these programs have in common is they replace parents' independent struggles with giving parents power to bring in local trusted professional experts, people like tutors and teachers and counselors and dentists and nurses and doctors, to get the kinds of support that are currently really only available to rich kids in our society.
Child care, as we mentioned, is like one of the ones I think everyone thinks about right now. Lots of discussion at the national level about child care. Other countries are doing really innovative things to increase the supply of child care and ensure working families have supports for child care. Share more about why that is such an important issue in your framework for stopping the overwhelming of parents and fixing the inequality crisis.
When kids begin kindergarten in America today, you already see rich kids and poor kids looking completely different in terms of how they perform on tests and how their teachers rate them in terms of their behavioral skills. Right off the bat, before we have even begun giving kids the wonderful opportunity to take advantage of public education, we have set up lower income kids to fail. And that is because we don't provide anything equivalent to public education in those first 5 years of life. And now we know that this is not just a time when kids should be roaming around their house or watching TV or doing whatever keeps them healthy and well fed. That's not enough. We now know that kids really need choreographed intellectual, cognitive, behavioral kinds of stimulation during this early period. We also know that the early learning system has to be high quality. We can't shortchange this. There have been honestly frightening studies in some cities in the world, in Quebec and in Bologna and Italy, showing that if we don't invest in a really high quality education system in these early years, it can cause harm to some of the kids, especially the middle class and upper middle class kids who might otherwise have, on average, more stimulating environments provided to them in these early years. But we do know that in other places like Boston and Norway, when the public has made sufficient investments in a high quality early learning system, it really benefits all kids. So this is just a mission critical priority for our society to take advantage of its own human talent.
Why is such an approach? You talked about childcare, you talked about out of school time, you talked about foster care, transitioning into college or post-high school success pathways, and supporting all of that with deeper public and more systemic investment. Why is such an approach an imperative for our national economy and for state economies?
Our annual GDP consists of contributions of labor and capital. About 60% of it is labor. It's the application of human skill to solve economic problems. The kinds of investments we're talking about here, which I in the book I call it family care, to model it on Medicare, and it's pooling together all these rich investments to round out our existing public education system. They're building up the quality of our labor supply. It's making this fundamental part of our economy, our labor force, perform better, capable of more. It's taking advantage of the skills that people could develop with the right kinds of opportunities. It is also making America more American by giving poor kids and rich kids the same chances to succeed. And I think that would just change the tenor and the perception of fairness in our broader society in really valuable ways.
It's investing in the American dream is what I hear you saying.
That's absolutely right, because I just thought we were missing a big opportunity in America to help a lot of people lead more successful, more innovative, happier lives.
Nate Hilger, author of the book, The Parent Trap, How to Stop Overwhelming Parents and Fix Our Inequality Crisis. Thank you for joining us on Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having me, Bridget.
Coming up after the break, whose successful political campaign slogan was Unbought and Unbossed, and what is a GRAC? I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Berea College. With a commitment to serving Appalachian students, Berea has not charged tuition since 1892. All students participate in a paid work program providing professional experience as well as an inclusive, supportive education. Details at berea.edu.
This is Tom Martin. Over the course of our recent six-part documentary series, Rise, about flooding in eastern Kentucky, one issue kept coming up time and again.
Our housing market is broken fundamentally.
We need more housing and we need it quick.
We deserve safe, decent, affordable housing just like everyone else.
This is going to be sort of what makes the difference in my view, whether this housing is ends up being rebuilt or not.
You can listen to the entire Rise series on demand online at weku-rise.org. More to come from the Eastern Standard team in the months ahead.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Unbought and Unbossed was the campaign slogan of the first African-American woman elected to Congress. And there's a book about her, as we hear in this latest episode of Gerald Smith's series on racial justice and equality.
Dr. Anastasia Kerwood is professor of history, interim chair of the Department of History, and director of the Commonwealth Institute of Black Studies at the University of Kentucky. She earned her MA and PhD in history from Princeton University, and her work has been recognized with fellowships from the Ford Foundation, the Institute for Citizens and Scholars, and the James Weldon Johnson Institute for the Study of Race and Difference at Emory University. Professor Kerwood joined the Department of History at UK in 2014. Her first book, Stormy Weather, Middle-Class African-American Marriages Between the Two World Wars, is an original and skillful exploration of the public and private lives of couples facing discrimination, racism, and segregation in American society. Her second book, Shirley Chisholm, Champion of Black Feminist Power Politics, is published by the University of North Carolina Press and is already receiving a lot of buzz. I should also mention that in her spare time, Dr. Carewood is a competitive equestrian. Dr. Carewood, welcome to Eastern Standard.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
You are most welcome. I want to begin by you sharing with the audience some information about Shirley Chisholm and her place in American history.
Well, the very basics are that Shirley Chisholm was a congresswoman from Brooklyn, New York. She represented the neighborhood of Bedford-Stuyvesant, as well as a few other neighborhoods. And she won her seat in 1968. That was the same year that Richard Nixon was elected to the presidency. But it was also the same year that the most Black congressmen and women were elected to the U.S. Both houses of the U.S. legislature since Reconstruction. There were a total of 7 members at that time. And she represented her district for 14 years. But in the meantime, she ran for president in 1972. And she ran a campaign that was eventually got to the Democratic National Convention. It ignited the political careers of young people at the time. And it really was quite ahead of its time in terms of its ambition to bring a coalition of Black people, women, poor people, young people into the political process. And I should also have said that Shirley Chisholm was the first Black congresswoman in the U.S. House.
Now, when did she pass?
She passed away in 2005, and it was just a month or two after a really wonderful documentary was made about her that's called Unbought and Unbossed. That was her favorite slogan.
Okay, why was that her favorite slogan?
Well, I'm glad you asked. So it came from her first congressional campaign, and the party bosses in Brooklyn, New York, and in New York in general, had a real stranglehold on elections and who could run and who could actually win. They would decide who would win by funding funding campaigns and also in sending out the entire firepower of their organization to try to recruit votes. So those party bosses could sort of make somebody's political fortune and just in the blink of an eye. She didn't have the support of those party bosses, so she had to make her own support, and she was very, very clever about that, and she did it. And in the end, she didn't owe allegiance to any party boss in the county or in the state, frankly. As far as Unbought, also she's referring to the practice of paying or contributing to campaigns, politicians' campaigns, and then expecting something in return, a little bit of a quid pro quo. And she, too, would not take any such money. So she used that as the slogan, Unbought and Unbossed, as a proxy for her really having no interest beyond doing her best to serve the people. But of course, being a Black person, that carries another layer to it. Black independence and autonomy were incredibly important then, well, and now. And so she was sending a signal to Black people and over in nationally, not just locally.
Mm-hmm. So given the fact that there had already been a documentary film about her life. And I know in 2014, there was another biography on Shirley Chisholm. You know, why did you choose to write a biography about her?
Well, the original reason was that I went looking for a biography of her. She had been a hero of mine since childhood. And I went looking for a biography of her and couldn't find one. And that was back in 2007, 2008. And, you know, my parents, I grew up in Massachusetts, and my parents were involved in her campaign for president in the state of Massachusetts. So I had heard from them about their experience. But I went looking. I was teaching a course on Black biographies as a professor at that time at Vanderbilt University, and I was looking for a book that I could use to talk about her and couldn't find one. So I thought, oh gosh, I've got to write this. Somebody, more than one wise person has said, we need to write the books that we wish we could read. And so that is what I set out to do. Now, it took me over 12 years. I think it took about 15, if you include from when I had the idea to when it actually is getting published. So it's been a work to bring it forward. The film is inspirational. It's mostly about the campaign, and it actually, the interviews that the filmmaker Shala Lynch conducted were invaluable sources for me to write the book. She left out, in order to create a 75-minute film, she left out much more of the interviews that she conducted than she could include. And those are just a gold mine as far as finding out what happened in Shirley Chisholm's life and her campaign. The book in 2014 is written by a really wonderful colleague, Barbara Winslow. She created a version that's more for an undergraduate classroom, more of an overview, and based on sort of existing sources, especially Shirley Chisholm's memoir. I went back and I started from the beginning. I did the genealogy for her family in Barbados, and I retraced her steps through Brooklyn and into Washington, talked to staffers of hers, really reconstructed her entire life from the ground up. And so that's why it took me so long. And that's what I thought needed to happen to give justice to this incredible historical person.
Mm-hmm. What kind of politician do you think she would be in the current political environment?
What I can tell you is that she really valued coalitions. And she was so practical when it came to wielding political power that she didn't get overly hung up on who she was in coalition with. She would identify a common interest, and she didn't really care about somebody's motivations or changing their minds or changing their hearts. She just cared about, well, do I share an interest with this person, and how could I get them to help me bring about what I need? And so she made some pretty unlikely coalitions. For example, she was an advocate for Title IX for equal participation of men and women in sports. And what was interesting was that she would talk to men colleagues who maybe weren't feminists, but who had family members who were women who might want to participate in sports. And so she was really able to not say, well, this is, you know, a woman's right, et cetera, et cetera. She would say, well, how do you feel about your child's opportunity? And she was a great retail politician, a one-on-one politician among her colleagues. She had people coming in and out of her office, and she would talk through things and break it all down for them. Some of them didn't want to be seen entering or leaving her office, so staff would help with that a little bit too. But she would wheel and deal in the nicest kind of way to get people to come around to where they needed to be in order to vote on her legislation.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you hope readers take away from reading your book?
One of my favorite lines from the book, if I may be not modest, is... in the closing of the introduction, and I'll just read it to you. Chisholm's life, both in its symbolism and its humanity, illuminate the way for new generations. It's hard to demystify our heroes. Still, we need to see them as human so that the humans of the future can see themselves as heroes. And so that's really what I want people to take from this book, that to do something truly extraordinary, you don't have to be a hero in a cape. You can just be human and undertake your best work at what you really care about.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, listen, I want to close by discussing your leadership of the Commonwealth Institute of Black Studies. And because you wear many hats as a professor of history, as interim chair of the Department of History, and now director of the Commonwealth Institute of Black Studies. So just let's take a couple of minutes sort of discussing the Institute. You know, when was it created? What is its purpose? How is it financed? And is there any upcoming events that you want to make mention of?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Well, you know, you're not giving yourself enough credit here. Back when you were leading African American studies at University of Kentucky, you laid some of the groundwork for having a research institute in Black studies. And the time for creating this formally really arrived in 2020 after the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And we had been wanting to both create an incubator for the really good research that our world-class over four dozen faculty in Black studies are doing here at UK. And we also wanted to have a showcase and an outreach arm for bringing what it is that we're doing to a larger audience. So what we did was we created some structure and some programming, ways to fund group and individual projects, ways to fund student work. And we made a case to the University of Kentucky administration, who came through with some permanent funding for us. First, some seed funding of $250,000 in the fall of 2020. And then now we have a standing appropriation from the upper administration. And so that has enabled us to do, as you said, a lot of programming, events, fund research that will become the knowledge of the future. So we have had a couple of events already. We discussed Black superheroes. We've had a guest, a Zimbabwean musician, come to campus. And of course, we'll be having our Black Women's Conference in March. So we're very busy.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kerwood. That's Dr. Anastasia Kerwood, professor of history and author of the new book, Shirley Chisholm, Champion of Black Feminist Power Politics. I'm Gerald Smith with Eastern Standard.
This year's Black Women's Conference is set for March 24th and 25th. It'll be virtual, and there are more details online. Just Google Commonwealth Institute for Black Studies. Lexington has Broadway veterans Jeremy and Lindy Franklin Smith leading the Lexington Theater Company, and it seems to be contagious. Theater series host Bill McCann says they caught the bug over in Mount Sterling.
Today, my guest is Jordan Campbell, executive director of the Gateway Regional Arts Center in Mount Sterling. Jordan grew up there, graduated from high school, then only recently became executive director of the GRAC. But his is not a straight line type story. It's rather circular. After high school, he went to Western Kentucky University for degrees in musical theater and political science. And then he moved to New York to pursue his dream of performing on Broadway, which led to opportunities to perform in national and international Broadway touring shows, performances at the Kennedy Center, the Grand Ole Opry, on television and films, and national commercials. He also has a degree from Harvard's Graduate School of Education and served in the Obama White House as a policy expert on theater and the arts, all of which could be the subject of several interviews. Instead, we'll focus on the GRAC's theater programming and events that are coming up during 2023. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Jordan Campbell.
Well, thank you, Bill. It's great to be here.
Your career has been diverse and exciting, from Broadway to performing around the world. Why on earth, Jordan, did you go back to Mount Sterling?
Well, that's a great question. I get that question a lot. And I am so blessed to be from such a beautiful community. I love Kentucky. If you talk to anybody that I've worked with over the years, no matter where it is, there's one thing that I always talk about outside of theater. that is Kentucky, and they know that I'm from Kentucky. And I'm proud that a lot of my colleagues from Washington, D.C., from New York, from national tours, they know about Mount Sterling, which is not everybody knows about Mount Sterling. So I'm very proud to be from here, and I carry it with me everywhere I've gone. And so when the opportunity became available, I was approached about coming back home to run the Arts Center in Mount Sterling. And without hesitation, I accepted the position. You know, I've gotten to see the world. I've gotten to learn all these amazing things about the arts. And now I get to bring those home and share those with the people I love most of all.
So the GRAC stands for Gateway Regional Arts Center. I understand you're offering theater classes.
Yes, we have something called the Academy at GRAC. So it's the Eastern Kentucky Academy for the Visual, Performing, and Literary Arts. And we are all the arts. We're all the art forms. We're not just a gallery for paintings. People have a misconception about our arts center in Mount Sterling. We are all the arts for all the people. So our theater classes, though, are part of our academy. We have introduction to acting. We have adult classes and youth classes. We also are starting an improv troupe. So for folks who want to just come out and maybe learn how to tell a joke or to, you know, maybe just want to get to know some other people, and theater is a great way to do that. We have a lot of opportunities for that in our academy. And folks can sign up for those at GRAC Kentucky, spelled out. So GRACKentucky.org/academy.
Okay, great. So what is improv?
Improv is short for improvisation or improvisational acting, which means kind of doing it off the cuff. A lot of times you're writing your own script as it happens, or you're thinking of it on the spot, which sounds scary, but a lot of times we do that in everyday life, right? So improv acting actually prepares people for public speaking. It prepares them for challenges they might face. So it's bigger than just theater. You know, it's not, we don't expect everybody to become a world famous actor, but theater has a lot of skills within it that can help you with other things in life as well.
You are a regional arts center, and one of those things that you do is work with the Menifee County Community Theater. How is that working? What do you do together?
We are a regional arts center, as you said, and so our mission is to really go outside of the confines of Montgomery County. We have folks come from all over the state, as far as Frankfort, as far as Ashland, Berea. We have people come from all over to see performances, to take classes, all different types of events. And so we're really glad that we have that regional kind of feel. And one of our missions is to reach out to those counties directly around us, one of them being Menifee County. So we have a great relationship with the Menifee Community Theater Group out of Frenchburg. And actually, one of my board members, Tyler Wells, runs that group and is a great, great resource for that community. And they've had wonderful productions. We, in the past couple of years, our organization has partnered with them, and we actually worked with them on our recent production of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the musical. But we share resources, and we also try to help them have more of an audience in Mount Sterling as well. You know, you have more people who, which means more tickets sold, you know, you have a bigger audience, wider appeal. So they are doing a production of Clue, which is the stage production of the movie Clue, which is based on the board game Clue. So they're going to be doing a production at GRAC this summer in June. Dates to be determined. And we're actually going to be holding auditions soon for that as well.
So how does it work exactly? Mm-hmm. You do performances in two communities? Is that it?
Yes. It's almost like a little mini tour, right? So they will perform in Menifee County. They perform in Frenchburg. And then they also do performances in Mount Sterling. All of their ticketing goes through our website so that it's a little bit more streamlined. And that's a resource that we can provide for them. And of course, we have at the Arts Center in Mount Sterling, we have dressing rooms, we have a PA system, we have, you know, the full lighting and sound capabilities as well. So we really appreciate our partnership with them, and we look forward to seeing that grow.
Okay. What else are you doing this summer in terms of theater activities?
So we have our annual youth programming in the summer. We have a camp that has been running for now. This will be the 31st year. Last year, we celebrated the 30th anniversary of Summer Playhouse and Summer Stock. Those are for elementary and middle-aged middle school age students, and run the gamut in terms of introduction to theater. So Yancey Hike, who is from Mount Sterling, who has been running that for 31 years. She is just wonderful with the kids, and she knows how to put up a production in 1 week. It's always amazing. By Saturday, they have a play. So they do two productions, two plays. The Playhouse group does a production, and the Stock group does a production. Last summer, as a, you know, a surprise to Yancey and to expand our programming, we've had a lot of interest in kids who are either too young for these programs or kids who have aged out of it and are moving on to, you know, eighth grade and into high school, who want to continue this program, but they're too old or they are too young to start it, right? So last year, we announced that we're actually adding two more programs to that. So we're continuing the two core programs, and we're adding something called Summer Imagination, which is for early childhood education in theater.
How young?
All the way to threes and fours. We're going to have threes and fours will be our youngest students in that. So we're excited to really get them started young, almost in a preschool-like environment, which if you've ever been in a preschool class, it's basically a theater class anyway, you know, dress up and centers and all that fun stuff. So we'll have the Summer Imagination, Summer Playhouse, Summer Stock, as always. And then we're adding Summer Stage, which is going to be primarily for high school-aged students, who will then put on a Shakespeare play at the end of their program. And we will have Shakespeare in the Park in Mount Sterling, which is great. So they're going to be performing in one of our beautiful downtown parks in Mount Sterling. And we also want to tie in, I know that EKU has a great connection here, but we also want to tie the roots of Appalachian English into Shakespeare as well, and how a lot of the vernacular and some of the phrasing and also the dialect of what would have been Shakespeare's time actually are very similar to that of Appalachian English. So that's a connection we want to make for our young people too.
Okay. Well, finally, let's talk about the Eastern Kentucky New Plays Festival. What is that and when's it going to happen?
Yes. So in September of 2023, we are so excited to announce right here on your show for the first time ever, the Eastern Kentucky New Plays Festival in Mount Sterling. So we are thrilled to offer another New Plays festival here in Kentucky. I know there are others, and so we don't ever want to detract from those. We actually want to add to the cacophony of beautiful playwriting that comes out of this state and the tradition of storytelling. We want to honor that, and we want to really focus in on those Eastern Kentucky counties.
I've been speaking today with Jordan Campbell, the executive director of the Gateway Regional Arts Center in Mount Sterling. Thank you for being here today, Jordan.
Thanks, Bill. Always great to be with you.
For Eastern Standard, this is Bill McCann.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the coming edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.